Recording has started.
Thank you very much. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPMs, and All GTLD PDP Working Group call held on Wednesday, the 1st of August, 2018 at 1700 UTC. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge, would you please let yourself be known now?
Rebecca Tushnet.
Thank you, Rebecca. Anyone else? Okay. And hearing no more names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. And with this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Kathy Kleinman. Please begin.
Hello, everyone. This is Kathy Kleinman, one of the three co-chairs, of course, with Phil Corwin and Brian Beckham of the working group, and welcome back to a full working group meeting. It's been a while, I guess, since Panama City, and today is an exciting event as the three URS data subteams report back with their thoughts, their draft recommendations, their ideas for our discussion, and we begin to pull the material together. Today is mostly about presenting, because there's a lot of material to present from the three subteams, which have been hard at work. Although, you know, feel free to make comments. It will be kind of through the rest of August that we'll be discussing and debating and coordinating what the recommendations are. So anything you hear today is a draft. First, I should pause and to Julie Hedlund, I can't see the cue, but are there any updates to statements of interest?
And Kathy, this is Julie Hedlund from staff. I see no hands raised.
Okay, terrific. And so before we start the URS subteam presentations, which I'm really looking forward to hearing the recommendations on, will be practitioners, and then I know Phil and Brian were talking about the order between providers and document subteam and which order they'll be in. But before we start that, there's also an update from the Trademark Clearinghouse data subteam that was working on the surveys with the analysis group, and I'm going to turn that over to Julie to give us the update on that.
I think, I'm sorry, this is Julie Hedlund from ICANN staff, pardon me. The way where we stand with the surveys being prepared by the analysis group and worked on by the data subteam is that, and these are the Sunrise and Claims surveys, these are being finalized. Final versions have been sent to the subteam for a last look, after which point there will be a beta testing, short beta testing phase. And so what we'd like to do is ask the working group members whether or not you would like to volunteer to be a beta tester. We just need a few people. And this is open, of course, to data subteam members as well, but we thought it might be useful to have someone who is not, have people that were not familiar with the surveys to test them, just because it might be an easier way for people to see if there's something that's not clear or something that needs to be improved. So we're making that announcement here. We'll follow it up with an email. So please let us know on the list, or you can contact us staff directly whether or not you would like to be a beta tester for the Sunrise and Claims surveys. And that would happen in really in the next week, because we do need to finalize them and get them sent out according to our timeline. And as Mary's noting, we're advised that around 3 to 4 beta testers per survey is optimal, and yes, preferably not those involved in developing questions. So that's the announcement and where we stand right now, and over to you, Kathy.
Terrific. Thank you, Julie, and thank you to the Trademark Clearinghouse data subteam, which has been meeting, we can't even tell you how many hours that subteam has put into the work and then meeting with the analysis group to frame the survey. So it's great to see that it's on the cusp of being ready to go out. Are there volunteers, Julie? Are you seeing volunteer, either hands raised or anybody in the chat room volunteering?
Thanks, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. There's no hands raised at this moment, but we'll also send a note out to the list following this call, and perhaps people might respond there as well.
Perfect. In that case, I think the next item on the agenda that I can't see would be the starting of the URS sub-team presentations, and the first would be Jason Schaefer, who's been our hardworking chair of the practitioners URS sub-team. Jason, go ahead, please, and I'm assuming that the document that you worked on with the sub-team is posted for review in Adobe Connect. If that's not the case, you know, please point that out.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. Julie, do we have that sub-team presentation that was circulated available for the screen?
And we do, and well, I'm just pulling it up right now. Hold on.
Okay.
And it's up. And would you like us to move the slides, staff to move the slides, or would you like us to make you a presenter?
Sure. I mean, you could make me a presenter. That'll make it easier.
Okay. You are now a presenter. Thanks, Jason.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, everyone. On screen is a short summary, and I'd like to again thank our sub-team, our working group. We had a sub-team, and we also had a sub-sub-team that did a heavy lifting on this project over the past number of months. As hopefully many of you will recall, we did have a presentation in Panama in the ICANN 62 meeting where we summarized and reviewed the survey results. As you may recall, those survey results were based on the following. The bullet points are on screen. We had a survey of 14 practitioners that responded from it was a list of about 34 practitioners in total. 13 of the 14 were representing the complainants. And we think that this data has some instructional value because of the 13 parties, those parties represented between 91 and 120 cases of the total of about 827 URS cases that we've seen at the time of the survey. Now, before I go to the next slide and before we continue, there has been some concern raised. It was raised in Panama and recently raised again about the validity of the survey and how we use this data, and I think one point I would like to make is a brief one to kind of address that question, and that is that by its nature, unfortunately, this survey has a structural limitation built into it because by its nature, very few respondents retain counsel in these cases. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is a fact. And in cases, many cases, it defaults, and in other cases, it's just pro se respondents. So, in order for us to get a truly balanced survey, it's pretty difficult to get respondents' feedback in an equal or representative capacity as what complainants have done. So that's a structural limitation. That's not to say that this data is not useful. In fact, I will say that having been part of this throughout the entire process, I think we have some very good feedback here about how the URS is working and that, in fact, the URS as designed is fit for purpose. So we can move on, but that's a point that's been raised again and a number of times, and I just wanted to address that up front. With that said, move on. As I said, overall, the practitioner survey and the results indicate that practitioners have a positive view of the URS and find it to be an effective rights protection mechanism. So that's a good thing. Practitioners believe that it's being used for the clear cases of abuse as it was designed to do. Another takeaway is that of the practitioners that have used appellate mechanisms, they have a generally positive experience there. And most found that the determinations were based on the rules. So those are the good points and the good takeaways from this data. Continuing on, the standard of proof seems to be adequate. Most of the parties responded that the existing limitations on evidence are appropriate. Most of the respondents said that the URS, again, as I said, repeat it before, but is it an effective mechanism? And no one indicated, and this was a question that was debated, but no one indicated any experience with an examiner having an actual or potential conflict of interest. So as we go through this, you know, it's helpful for me to provide a little context. There were many, many questions that we debated of putting into the survey, not putting into the survey, including, and I think it's fair if everyone who is commenting or concerned here take a step back and reflect that while we all may have certain fears or concerns about what's happening in the context of the URS, the survey seems to indicate that those fears, and I think the data subteam has some data on document subteam has some data to this point, that many of our fears or our concerns aren't just borne out in the data and it's just not happening. So as this point of we thought perhaps there might be conflicts of interest or certain biases, people are saying no, it doesn't seem to be the case. So that's a good thing. Next slide, the respondents found value in creating a, like the WIPO overview on UDRP, trying to create a similar overview on the URS. And while I think that would be a great action step to take, I mean, it may be very difficult to do at this time, you know, with the few amount of cases we have. The UDRP is, you know, very old, has a lot of prior cases, and that's a different animal altogether. But it's a good point to help practitioners, respondents, and I think panelists. Okay, moving on to the next point. This is a key point that we should be looking at as a possible area. One-third of the practitioners indicated problems with implementation of relief. And the review of those responses are that registrars might not be responding to the request for renewal of suspension. Some registrars don't understand the process. In some cases, a losing respondent is able to re-register a domain, and then in some cases, a cyber squatter might renew the domain. And then there were some specific problems with respect to Chinese registrars and their implementation. So some of those indicate that there might be a communications issue, an educational issue, but again, nothing's jumping out as a clear structural problem. Next slide. About half of the respondents indicated that there should be more guidance to educate and instruct the practitioners on the burdens of proof and the evidence. Another point was to take away is there was a split regarding the adequacy of relief. And some parties, not surprisingly, expressed a desire for a transfer. Others expressed the right of first refusal, and others sought a possibility for a negotiated transfer from a losing party to a prevailing party or cancellation of the domain. So, again, there's a number of points there. Final point there is some thought that the word limit of 500 words was too low. Someone called it arbitrary and insufficient. But, again, I caution any kind of conclusion here is that, you know, we always have to look at what's the purpose of the URS, how it's different than the UDRP, and why it's a fast, quick, inexpensive, and by design supposed to be an easy mechanism to implement. So if we, in this case, were to look at increasing the word limit or increasing the evidentiary issues, it would naturally change the nature of the RPM. So, what brings us to the conclusion? In summary, and as I said before, I think that our survey indicates that the URS is working for its intended purpose. It's addressing cases of clear abuse, which is what we all hoped it would do. And any of the problems that are indicated seem minor and can be fixed. So that is the overall summary of what our practitioner subteam was able to obtain. Any questions? Comments? George?
George Kourikos here for the transcript. Yeah, I just want to point out that I continue to disagree with your assessment. This is still a small sample, that could have been fixed by improving the data collection, not limiting it only to practitioners who'd done five or more cases, as I mentioned on the mailing list. It's like sampling a restaurant who's only with customers that have visited it five or more times. And so you're going to get only those who obviously like the food because they've gone there five times, and you're not going to get the sample of those who only visited once and didn't like the experience. And the second issue is the unrepresentative nature, as you obviously already alluded to. Here we're only really hearing one side of the debate, which is dominated by complainants. And, of course, they're happy because they win a large percentage of the case, and there's obvious due process concerns for respondents. And that's not being captured by this survey. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And of course, those points are noted, and I believe staff is noting them on the record. So, you know, we appreciate your comments, George, and I understand your position. Any other comments regarding the survey results or any questions on the – yes, go ahead, Greg. Greg, I don't think we can hear you.
Greg, I don't think we can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I think, first off, it wasn't just Jason's assessment that Jason stated, but rather the assessment of the sub-team. So it's not I don't think it's just Jason's personal opinion or viewpoint, although Jason is the one in the catbird seat at the moment, so that's what happens when you're sitting there. I would say that also when we started out to do this, we were looking at getting a surveying experienced practitioners, those who had multiple cases. Was not necessarily intended to be a perfectly representative sample. In the end, though, we did include those with few cases as well as those with many. And we had a 41% response rate, which is actually a very good response rate. If I did the math correctly, that was 14 out of 41. And so, you know, that's actually quite a decent response rate. In terms of sample size, we'd have to compare the sample size to the population size. I don't think there are that many folks that have compared that have been involved in URS. So 34 out of 200 or 300, it's probably not even 200, is also not a bad sample size. But again, this was not, I think, intended to perfectly replicate the sample to the population, so that may affect to some extent the ability to generalize from the survey to the population of all practitioners, but it doesn't invalidate in any way the facts of the survey itself. And lastly, I don't think we can assume necessarily that respondents' counsel would tell a different story, that this is one side of the story, or that the people who go to the URS repeatedly necessarily like it. They may think it's the best available solution, but they may not like it at all. I often go to the sandwich place closest to my office. It's not the place I like the most, but if I have 10 minutes to get a sandwich and get back to my desk, it's where I go. There are a lot of reasons for going places other than you like it. So I think we have to avoid making inferences that aren't supported by the data, and that may in fact be supported more by one's own bias in looking at the data. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. I see Brian. Brian, you have your hand up. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. Brian Beckham for the record. And I'm sorry if I missed this. I wasn't participating in the sub-team. But do you happen to know, Jason, to this question about the survey, I know there are a few attorneys on the full working group that do sometimes represent respondents. Do you happen to know if there was any anecdotal evidence shared from practitioners who might be active in this space to kind of fill out any of the perceived gaps in the survey?
So, Brian, you're referring to during during the many months we discussed this the survey, you're talking about, were there any anecdotal comments or inferences from parties? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, well, I guess it's maybe if the question is, did you guys maybe reach out to practitioners who you knew might be active in the space just to see if they had any anecdotes to share that wouldn't have necessarily been captured in the survey?
Sure.
And then, just to mention that, of course, there are some folks in the working group, and I would certainly hope that, now would be the time that if people have participated in URS proceedings that have concerns with that, this would be a great time to raise those.
Yes. So Brian, very good point, and thank you for raising that. Throughout this process, the many, many months that we've all worked on this, indeed before, even prior to the working group, the sub-team being created, I know there. I can speak personally with a few others on this in the working group that we actually did a lot of work trying to analyze the effectiveness of the URS itself. I can say that there were a couple of times where respondents counsel, those that are generally respondents counsel in UDRP proceedings, had a number of conversations regarding this. And, there is some information that, we gleaned. We looked at some data. We on our own looked at hundreds of cases to try to assess, is there a problem in the decision-making process with the URS? And we personally didn't find that. We did take an effort to try to see, are there any attorneys out there that are regularly representing respondents in URS cases? And again, not surprisingly, we found that that's just not the case. So what we're ending up with, again, as I said earlier, structurally, is a situation where even typical respondents' counsel are just not participating in the URS because most likely, and this is my own personal opinion, that this is just not something that a party would hire competent counsel to defend them in. And if it is a clear case of abuse, they wouldn't be hiring counsel. Maybe they would, but it's just not bearing out. Obviously, in a case, if there was a good faith dispute or good faith issue on the fair use of that domain, then I think you would find that they'd be hiring counsel. So that's an anecdotal point that we can present. I know that in my sub-team and the sub-sub-team, we had many conversations among trademark counsel and brand protection counsel that we debated these points, and we really tried hard to figure out from the original set of how many practitioners are out there and how many respondents are out there, how we can get the best result. And this is what happened. This is how it came back. So I appreciate everybody's concerns. They make sense. I understand George's points. I see that George wrote again in the text portion. George, we spent a lot of time going over this, and this was debated. Nobody on this group wants to have a biased survey by design. Certainly I don't. So I understand your points. Safe to say that it's a valuable survey. It should not be conclusive, but none of this should be conclusive. It's recommendations, and we can certainly take the data that we have, and it is instructive. As with anything else, what you do with it is what you choose. Phil, I see you have your hand up.
This is Rebecca Tushnet. Can I get on the queue?
Sure, Rebecca. I have Phil, Kathy, and then you. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. I'll be brief because we've got two other reports, but if there's another side of the story, this working group wants to hear it. I will say that, I follow the domain industry press. I often see stories regarding a UDRP case that people think was wrongly decided, or a case that in which the complainant lost, and there's an opinion that there should have been a finding of reverse domain name hijacking. I just haven't seen stories alleging abuse or misuse or misapplication of the URS. We've got three members of the ICA senior leadership of the ICA on this call. I think if professional investors were seeing problems with URS, they would know about it. We've got Gerald Levine, who reviews UDRP and URS decisions and is regarded as an expert. So by all means, if we can, if there's another side that shows that the policy is flawed or is being misapplied, we want to hear it, but I haven't seen any evidence, and we certainly have lots of folks involved with this working group who should know if that's a substantial problem. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Kathy?
Sorry, Jason, was that me? This is Kathy.
Yeah, yes, go ahead, Kathy.
Okay, great. Kathy Kleiman. I was a member of the sub-team as well, with not as co-chair, obviously, because Jason was the chair of the sub-team. And there was a lot of work, both in trying to decide, you know, from the list of practitioners, what group should be requested, and that was everyone who had five or more cases, and then working, you know, to come up with clear questions that people would respond to, and then the forum did the distribution for us. So we couldn't force people to respond, of course, but the forum sent several notices, which we greatly appreciate Renee doing, to the practitioners to encourage the response to the survey. So let's take it for what it was worth, and it's informing the debate, but it's just one of many inputs. And thanks again to the sub-team for all of its work.
Thanks, Kathy. And just to get back to Phil's point, Phil, you're correct. From our side and from the others that participated, we did not find any problems. We're not aware of those problems. They were not raised as far as Respondents' Council is concerned. So that those issues have not they just haven't shown up, and we're not aware of it. Rebecca?
Rebecca Teshnet. My apologies. My call dropped, so if I am repeating something, I don't mean to be. So I was just thinking about Brian's question about anecdotal evidence, and it occurs to me if we wanted to put in the recommendation something about this or our report and request it for comments, we did have two presentations from practitioners. One who did represent respondents, and I believe there were some anecdotal things that they mentioned. It might be worth putting in for flavor. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. Looks like Zach. Go ahead, Zach.
Thank you, Jason. Zach Muskovich. Just further to Phil's remarks and regarding the survey results and the conclusion, I want to share with you how I see it. The survey results are useful, and they contribute to our understanding as a group of whether the URS is working. And the conclusions that are drawn are indicative of those 13 or 14 complainants practitioners. And so I agree that those results are indicative of the views of those 13 or 14 complainant practitioners. But that's an important source of data. And that's what this procedure was all about, getting data from the URS providers, from practitioners, and from documents. But that is not to say that there's not another and equally important way of getting a greater understanding of whether the URS is working and what improvements can perhaps be made for them. And that's from participants in this group. And so although, Phil, you mentioned that there was ICA leadership on this call and you would have heard from them if there's any problems with the URS. Well, first of all, I wasn't asked whether I have recommendations, and I do have recommendations. I'd be happy to make those in due course. And second of all, the URS, I think that the study does bear the recommendations, as Jason pointed out, do generally bear out my anecdotal understanding, is that it has been working for the clear-cut cases, and there hasn't been any findings of abuse, and it's generally working. And that's my own assessment, which is anecdotally obtained from observing. But certainly there's areas for improvement. Certainly there's areas that I'd like to contribute to, so I don't think that it's appropriate to treat the survey results as the only yardstick about whether to gauge whether the URS is working and or could be improved. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Appreciate your comments and points. Well noted. It looks like we do need to wrap up to get to the next group. Phil, I see your hand is up.
Yeah, just to briefly respond to Zach, since he mentioned my name, and I appreciate Zach's comments. You know, any member of this working group, you don't need an invitation to speak on our calls or state anything on the email list. And when we start the decisional process on URS later this month, we welcome suggestions for change in the policy of the administration from any member of this working group based on any evidence they wish to cite. I certainly never meant to suggest, and I don't know that Jason or Kathy did, that the survey should be the only thing we consider. It's just one thing that we can consider, and it's up to the working group members what weight to give it, and if there's consensus for change, we'll recommend change. If there isn't, we won't do it. Thanks.
Thanks, Phil. Greg, your hand is up. Just quickly, we can move forward.
Thanks. It's Greg Chatton for the record. I actually agree with a lot of what Zach said, and it's more of a general caution to this group with all of the surveys and outside data collection elements, and I've noticed this not just in this working group but in other working groups I've been involved in, that when you start going outside for information, there seems to be a tendency to stop or to not look as much to the group. I mean, let's recall what the initial concept of the working group was to actually really draw on the opinions and experiences and viewpoints of the participants. And it's great to get outside information, but that's, and sometimes, and it can be used in a variety of different ways. It can be seen as a variety of different things. But the bottom line is that here and elsewhere, increasing tendency to look for information outside should not be coupled with a decreasing tendency for the working group, its participants, to engage in robust discussions, and nor should it be seen as somehow that any one person's opinion is worth less than some survey result necessarily. Ultimately, the issue here is looking at the issues and being persuasive and understanding the concerns and using a variety of inputs. But we should never become just a bunch of folks just wrangling outside data without really, participating in the working group experience fully as participants. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Go ahead, George.
George Rico again. Yeah, I just want to make a constructive suggestion, namely that we do have the properly constructed survey questions. So I don't know how hard it would be. I think it would be relatively simple, but presumably NAF and the other URS providers have a list of all the respondents or the complainants that had four or fewer disputes under their belt. So I think the survey can just be mailed out to all those other participants, and we'd get that larger survey data, and it would give us a much more useful data set than we have presently. Thanks.
Thanks, George. One point for the record before we move on, I want to be clear. We do have, which is actually interesting, and important to note, we do have a respondent perspective here. This is not completely complainants, although 13 out of 14 is certainly is heavy. You do have a respondent's response here. So, again, it is not, again, to echo what Phil said, everybody's saying here, what I try to indicate, yes, we have our work to do. We are all parties to this. This working group needs to do its job. This data is useful. It's not conclusive. That's what I said at the outset. I think we can all agree on that. It illuminates and illustrates certain points and highlights issues, but nothing here is conclusive, and nor should it be taken as such. Barry, go ahead.
And this is Kathy. Everyone briefly, please, because we do need to move on to the document subteam. And we'll have lots of opportunity to talk about this later.
Right.
Thanks.
Barry, go ahead.
Thank you, Barry Cobb, for the record. I just wanted to point out a quick data element which could have been useful for your team, but just got to it now. But essentially, of the 870 cases, there were only 38 cases that contained a response where legal counsel was also a part of that case, and only 21 unique counsel or practitioners were extracted out of the data that Rebecca's team had put together when they did the coding exercise. So it is a very small universe of those, and it looks, you know, again, it's just a quick scan, but several of those are looked to either had privacy assigned to it, so it's difficult to actually see if there was an actual practitioner there or not. But it is a very small subset of the overall cases, especially even those where a response was filed. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry. Okay. We really do need to move on because I need to make sure everybody else gets their time, providers and documents. George, your hand is up, so let's try to be quick and wrap it up.
Yeah. I don't want to be pedantic. George Kriegel's again for the transcript. I don't want to be pedantic, but the reason why we do statistics is that we have a sample that is used to gather statistics, and you can, if the sample is of a large enough size, you can extrapolate those findings to the larger group. And here we have a case where it's unrepresentative because more than 90% of the respondents are representing complainants instead of the respondents of a dispute. So it's kind of like doing a presidential poll where over the 95% of those surveyed are Democrats instead of Republicans. Of course, you're going to get results that can't be properly extrapolated towards what the election result is going to be. And so that's all I'm saying here, that we don't really have a representative sample, you know, unless you're going to weight John Berryhill's response 13 times more than what it should be to kind of even things out, which is kind of what they do in you know, election polls. They do that weighting. And obviously, you know, weighting that one person is very difficult to do. The real solution is to go out and get more data. Like, it shouldn't have been limited to just, you know, five or more respondents. That was like a fundamental flaw that should have been brought to the attention of the main group. And so if it's not going to be, responding to Barry's point about number of those that were represented by counsel, then just survey the respondents themselves. They would be in the best position to know whether the process worked for them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, George. Appreciate your comments and concerns. Kathy, was
thank you?
You,
Jason. Thank you, Jason, and
okay.
The practitioner subteam for the presentation. Anything else, Jason, or should we kind of give the material to the working group and move on?
No, I'd like to wrap it off and hand it off to the next group. Again, the only thing I'd like to include is that, you know, on both sides of this issue. Again, I caution everyone, including you, George, and including all the others, you know, what are the fears that we have, and are they actually legitimate fears, or are they just our own biases? Everybody needs to come to the table with that, and if those fears are not really borne out, you know, then maybe there really is not a big problem. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I'm not seeing it. I know others are not seeing it. George, I'd ask you to consider what is your fear that is happening to respondents that we're not aware of. A lot of competent people are participating in this working group, and including yourself, you're participating, so we just need to move on. We have the same issues with the document subteam and the data. These are all useful points, but I think we can move on, and let's just use this for what it's worth. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Jason. And this is Kathy signing off and handing it over to Brian Beckham, both to present and to run the meeting. And he'll hand it over to Phil from there. Over to you, Brian.
Thanks very much, Kathy, and thanks, Jason. Just my own quick summary, it sounds like a lot of good information from the presentation we just got, and maybe a few things to get us a little bit further across the finish line, but really appreciate that. So this is the presentation from the document subteam. And for just to refresh our memories, the document subteam was formed to identify sources of data where we might find answers to some of the charter questions where we were looking to provide answers and data points to help us with our effort here. We actually finished that phase of the work quite early. At the time Jay Scott was leading that particular subteam, I think we had three or four phone calls where we kind of went through the URS documents chart staff helpfully prepared. If you all recall, at some earlier point, we took some of the charter questions and we tried to sort of rework those into the five overarching themes that Heather had kind of reframed for us. And then there were, I think, about a dozen broader themes. So there were things like the complaint, the response, the fees, things like that. And so what we did was we went through each of those themes and we thought, where are the places where we might be able to identify data that would help inform our discussions on that particular theme? So like I say, we had the good fortune in that subteam of finishing that work quite early. So we were presented with a little bit of a fork in the road at that point as to what to do, and this primarily revolved around the question of the kind of broader review of the URS determinations. And so just to sort of test the waters a little bit, if you will, what we decided was we would review, I think it was 14 cases where there was an appeal. And so that was kind of the next phase of this document subteam work. And once we concluded that, we then went back through our initial exercise of identifying the data sources. And over the past month or so, we went back and we said, okay, well, we identified the data source. Some of it revolved around information coming in from other subteams. So this would be, for example, the practitioner and provider surveys. And we thought, well, let's have a look and see what those surveys actually told us and what the reviews of I mentioned we did the initial review of the appeals cases. We then looked at a kind of a broader subset of cases where there was a de novo review, et cetera. And so we went kind of line by line through this chart, through each of the dozen or so themes, and we looked what was the data source, what did it tell us, and then we started to try to pull together recommendations. So with that, we have 9 substantive slides, and I apologize, I should have had this slide up as I was just talking, but this effectively kind of re-summarizes what I just summarized in terms of the initial genesis of this subteam and where we are today. So where we are is we started to look at the documents chart again, sorry, the URS chart again, and we went topic by topic through and saw, you know, what did the data tell us? In effect, I would say that kind of along the lines which was mentioned earlier, we came to the conclusion that overall things seemed to be working as intended with the URS, and there were some kind of minor areas for improvements, and so we'll try to walk through some of those. So you see on the screen, the first topic that we went through was the complaint, and part of this was in the kind of the first bucket was the administrative review that the providers undertake, and then there was another question about the types of marks that are included in complaints and in decisions. And so you see there on the administrative review side, primarily based on the feedback from the provider survey, there didn't seem to be anything jumping out at us that was screaming for any policy recommendations. You see the second bullet there, that goes to the question that I mentioned earlier about the types of marks. Part of this, of course, related to questions that had been raised earlier about the nature of marks, namely some marks that were dictionary terms or used in a trademark sense and what that meant for recipients of a trademark claims notice. But, of course, that's a completely different topic than the URS that we're on now. You see the next bullet is the filing period and the word limit. And so there was feedback from the practitioners, and I believe even a little bit from the providers which effectively was reflecting feedback they had from filing parties. There were some suggestions asking whether the current word limits were appropriate for the URS, and so we just identified that as an area where people had some views. We did think it was important to recall that, of course, any recommendation that seeks to kind of expand the parameters of the URS, if you will, whether that's timelines, word limits, fees, things of that nature, the remedy is another good example. That, of course, the URS was meant to be a complement to the UDRP. So to the extent we start to kind of, you know, suggest changes to the URS that take it more into UDRP territory, the sub-team thought that was certainly something that the full working group should bear in mind, you know, just to make sure that we're coming out at the end of the day, if that's our indeed intended policy recommendation, with a mechanism that complements the UDRP, but not to have two mechanisms which effectively do the same thing. You see on the bottom there, the one outstanding action item, there were some questions about the SMB files, and I actually went on the Trademark Clearinghouse website this week, and they have an example you can see of an SMB file, and this relates to a comment I made in the chat earlier during Jason's presentation, which was that there were some concerns raised by practitioners that there wasn't sufficient information in the SMB file for them to actually, you know, see what was the relevant mark, the jurisdiction, the dates, that sort of thing. And so there's an action item for staff to see if there's either some sort of decoding software that would help unpack that a little bit, or indeed whether it might be possible to include the information that's not in there that practitioners would find useful. The next topic was the notice of the complaint to a respondent. And so you see that there was some feedback from the providers that there were no specific issues identified from the practitioners, but from the providers, there may be some need for additional policy work. And then in terms of the role of the registry operators and registrars, the providers, of course, for you that were involved in that sub-team, this will be no surprise, but the providers identified that they had overall things were working well, but they had a few instances where they had difficulty getting registries or registrars to timely provide answers to their questions, or in some cases implement the decision to suspend the domain name. And so that's something that has been noted. The action item that relates to that was, and you see at the very bottom of this slide, there's just a note that we need to obviously be careful not to overload people with requests for information. But the action item was to contact the top registry operators that had actually had a URS case filed under their registry, and to see if they couldn't help shed a little bit of light on this question about just the communications and how that worked between the providers and the registries and the registrars. But, of course, we want to kind of make sure that we're not overloading them, so that staff was going to help us look at what would be the best timing for that depending on the Sunrise and the claims survey issuance dates. The next topic that we covered was the response, and this included the duration, the fees, and anything related to the response. And you'll see in a subsequent slide, we refer actually back to this slide on topic C on the response. Again, based on the practitioner survey, at least for the document sub-team, we didn't identify any additional areas where policy work seemed to be required. You see there some of the statistics that were pulled out of the research. This was the Excel spreadsheet that Rebecca Tushnet helpfully shared with the working group. And so you see the number of cases where there was a response filed generally and then within the 14-day response period, and then the cases where a response was denied. And you'll see on a later slide, we had an open question as to the exact kind of relation of the different response opportunities and the timelines related around that. And we had a good conversation within our sub-team over the past week or two, but we thought that was, frankly, an open item that we wanted to flag up for the full working group. And then you see, in terms of the question about the response fee for the cases where there were 15 or more disputed domain names, Unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of information to pull out of that because all of the cases where there were 15 or more cases did not have a response. So we thought this was probably something that we wanted to simply flag as an open item where we didn't have any particular data pointing us in one direction or another in terms of a policy recommendation. So we wanted to positively, seek feedback during the issuance of our initial report from the community, if there's anything that can be drawn from that. The next topic we covered was the standard of proof. Just to recall, in the UDRP, that's often expressed as on balance or the balance of probabilities, and in the URS, that's a clear and convincing standard. So one of the things we discussed in our last call was there's not necessarily a specific numeric threshold for this clear and convincing standard, but it's supposed to be some of the terms that have been used in the policy development for the URS were slam dunk or black and white, and I believe in the IRT bringing this together, the thought was that it was so obvious that you could decide this over a cup of coffee. So it was really just meant to be open and shut, no open questions. Either it's decided one way or the other quickly, and it doesn't require a tremendous amount of information in front of the examiner. So the one thing that did come of this, so the overall recommendation was, and again, this relates to the idea that there's meant to be a URS, which is a lighter complement to the UDRP. So we thought certainly there was no data that pointed to us to any conclusion otherwise, but we came to the conclusion that it didn't seem appropriate to recommend changing the burden of proof from the clear and convincing standard that the URS has. And again, this goes to it being a lighter, quicker, more obvious complement to the UDRP. The one thing that we did identify was the potential need for an examiner's guide to help them. For those of you who haven't actually looked at a URS determination, some of them are frankly difficult to understand. Some of them are pretty light on details. When you strip away some of the kind of standard information, the recitation of the URS policy and procedure elements, the party names, things like this, in some cases, frankly, you're not left with a lot of information. And so that makes it difficult for someone who hasn't been privy to the pleadings to understand why the determination went in the direction it did. And it was interesting, when we looked at the IRT report, there was actually an appendix which suggested this very item, which was a kind of a checklist of the kind of core elements that ought to be in a URS determination. So you see, this wasn't meant to be necessarily the comprehensive list, but just some of the things that jumped out at us on the subteam were, the trademark at issue, the domain name at issue, some of the relevant dates, et cetera. And so this was one of the things that we flagged as a possible recommendation for the working group to consider. Talked earlier about the idea of an examiner's guide. So the examiner's guide that we talked about in this subteam was more kind of like a template, if you will, of what should be in a determination. And Jason mentioned earlier the idea of some sort of a jurisprudential overview. We wanted to caution that it was probably difficult to draw lines around what would be a hard versus an easy case. And also that the URS, it's only been in operation for a few years. We have actually, I think, less than 1,000 cases still, so it may be a little early to be able to draw up some sort of a jurisprudential guide. And, of course, the decisions themselves are a lot lighter than the PRP cases. So it could be that the URS simply doesn't lend itself as neatly to the type of, guide that you have in the WIPO overview as would be possible for the URS. And as Phil mentioned earlier, of course, it could be possible to draw some inferences from what's in the UDRP overview to the extent those could kind of map over to the URS. The next two topics on this screen that we looked at were the defenses and the remedies. On the defenses, this is an area where, of course, within the subteam, we were very well aware that there were some stakeholders who would prefer to have you know, additional defenses or less defenses, but there didn't seem to be any issues jumping out at us again here. There was, I apologize, I don't recall the title of the document, but there was actually towards the back of one of the documents that staff helpfully prepared, kind of summary of the defenses that were used in cases. And again, they seemed to be sort of, there weren't any particular themes where, you know, one defense was used much more than another. It seemed to be really down to the specifics of the case, and they seemed to be fairly comprehensive. And again, the actual URS spells out that these are examples of defenses. These aren't meant to be comprehensive. So the fact that most of them seem to be being used and they're non-exclusive led us to the conclusion that there wasn't a burning need to make any specific policy recommendation on additional defenses at this time. One of the questions that came up was the notion of delay or latches. We actually looked through the forum's database, and we didn't actually see any cases where this was actually a term that came up in the determination. That's not to say that a party wouldn't have raised it in its pleading, but if it weren't reflected in the determination, we wouldn't know that. And again, you see just the kind of final bullet in this section that the URS is actually still relatively young. I believe the first case was in 2014. So, you know, the theory behind delay, you know, it may be that it's too early to tell. I can say from kind of anecdotal experience in the UDRP type cases where it's raised, you tend to sometimes be looking at delay of a decade or more. And obviously that's simply not possible in the U.S. term since it's only been around for a few years. So again, this wasn't an issue that jumped out at us in terms of making a possible policy recommendation. In terms of the remedies, this was something where, on the one hand, we came to the conclusion that the suspension remedy was working as intended. Of course, we all know that this is what's in the terms of the URS itself, and this was something that was decided by the IRT, endorsed by the STI, and that's what we have today. And again, this goes to kind of the philosophical underpinning of the URS, which is that it's meant to be a lighter complement to the URP, which has a different transfer remedy. We were, of course, aware that there were stakeholders that would like to see a different remedy, but that, of course, is a bigger policy question that, frankly, we didn't see any data pointing us to a strong need to make a recommendation in that direction. And this is something where, you know, frankly, if people do feel that that's an appropriate remedy, that's something that's, you know, that's for them to put forward, whether in the context of this working group or comments on the initial report. But again, we didn't see any indication that the suspension remedy wasn't working or that it needed to be changed. There was one recommendation, and to be frank, I don't know how this would actually work in practice. Certainly, if people had more insight in this, that would be helpful. But there was a recommendation that once the suspension remedy ended in a URS case, to not allow that domain to be listed by a drop catching service. Again, I don't know how that would work, if it's even possible, but that was a recommendation that was made. So we wanted to make sure and capture that for the full working group to consider. The next topics we covered were the appeals and the overlapping process steps, and these kind of worked together in our discussions. So I mentioned earlier that once we concluded the first phase of our work, we moved to reviewing the 14 appeals cases, and once we had concluded with that work, we actually looked at the further, subset of the de novo review cases. And so you see in the majority of those cases, the complainant prevailed. During our call, David McCauley helped us. He actually looked through these de novo review cases, and I think the term that we kind of settled on in the subteam was that it seemed to be kind of a grab bag of cases, and there were no There were no themes that really jumped out, particularly by way of suggesting a particular policy recommendation one way or the other. As with the determinations generally, we thought, and again, David, certainly feel free to jump in and add anything here, but we thought that certainly with the appeals cases, some kind of clarity around the terminology, some of the terminology, the de novo, the appeal, the review, et cetera, seem to be kind of used interchangeably in some of the appeals determinations. And it wasn't always entirely clear what the prior history of the case was. Sorry, I see David has his hand up, so maybe I'll just let him jump in there. David, please.
Thanks, Brian. David McCauley for the record. I'll just say that having read a number of appeals and de novo reviews, I think you summarized it very well. But it is actually surprisingly, in my opinion at least, quite a problem. And that is when you review these cases, the terminology even within one case is quite confusing. And terms like complainant, respondent, appellant, appellee have to be standardized, in my view, so that the reader is not put through some tortuous reading cycle. And something like, you know, appellant, complainant below, or respondent below, something like that. And then in additionally using sections talking about the procedural history below, it's really scattered, varies all over the place. But if someone reads the procedural history in a determination, they may not come away with what comprehensively happened below. But anyway, you summarized it well. These are administrative issues that I think we might want to take a little bit of notice of. Thank you.
Thanks, David. And this is Brian again for the record. So the other recommendation where we did not come to any conclusion on the subteam was that there were up to three instances where a defaulting respondent could have the merits of the case heard. And so the question was whether this makes sense, whether it would be possible to consolidate those somehow. Again, we didn't come out with a concrete recommendation one way or the other. We just wanted to flag this as a potential area where there may be some streamlining possible and wanted to flag this up to the full working group for its consideration. And, of course, it may be even that within the working group there are different views, so this may be an area that we want to flag in the initial report for broader community feedback. On the next topic, cost, I mentioned earlier that we would kind of refer back to Section C, which was on the response fees, which we covered earlier, and on the loser pays model. Again, this was something that we didn't see anything jumping out at us, and we wanted to just flag that there may be feedback from the providers and practitioners. I recall from looking at the provider survey, there were some questions about how, if there was a loser pays model, it would work in practice, and whether that would require extra steps and whether those judgments would be, in fact, enforceable. So this was something where we, again, didn't come out with a strong recommendation, nor did we find any excuse me, data pointing us to a recommendation one way or the other. But wanted to make sure that we knew that even if people were suggesting it, that the providers had raised some questions about the kind of practical details of how a loser pays model would work. The next topic that we covered was language. And I think there were kind of two buckets here of language. There was one which was the language of the actual determination. And so there were a handful of cases. I think there were, you see down there, 30 cases where there was a question. In fact, I think I'm confusing the numbers there. In any event, there were a handful of cases where language was tagged as an issue in Rebecca Tushnet's research, and staff was going to go through and produce a summary of those to see. So basically, that would be a case where, for example, the complaint was filed in English. The registrar told the provider that the registration agreement was, for example, in French or Chinese or some other language than English, and then there's a question that the provider has to initially consider and then the examiner has to consider, which is what's the appropriate language of proceeding in that case, both for the actual proceeding and for the determination. And so this was an area where we wondered whether it would be useful to develop some guidance for both examiners and parties in cases as to what some of the forks in the road might be for language determination cases. One of the things, it's actually not here on the screen, but with respect to the language, there was a question, this goes to what we covered earlier in terms of the providers communicating with the registries and the registrars. And I think there was a question or a suggestion whether those communications, if providers were experiencing some difficulty, if kind of standardizing those communications would be useful. The next topic was abuse of process. And this was one where there was no data to really help us, look at this and make a recommendation one way or the other. None of the determinations from a search on the forum's website actually had a finding of an abusive complaint made. It could be that some respondents had alleged that, but the examiner didn't find that was appropriate to make a finding in that direction in the case. And if you recall, there were some penalties for abusive complaints. So I don't have those committed to memory, but I think there was sort of, if you were found to be having filed an abusive complaint once or twice, then you would get warned. And then if it happened a third time, I think you may have been barred from filing a further complaint for a year, or it may even be indefinitely. But in any event, we didn't see any data that led us to a recommendation that this abusive process provision in the ERS needed to be changed. The next topic of education and training, this has been raised on a few occasions, and there were some, one of the sources we looked at was the provider's websites. Of course, they have model pleadings that help parties understand the big picture. And I believe on one of the provider's website, they even had a reference to a training that they provided. But this was, again, an open question. Should there be some sort of a basic FAQ posted online? Should there be some sort of training? And this goes both to the parties and practitioners. And so this is something that we wanted to say that the provider's subteam may have additional suggestions here. But certainly the idea of some sort of a basic FAQ for parties was something that seemed to get some traction. And in parallel, I know in the provider survey, the question was asked what type of training they provided to the examiners. Finally, on the topic of providers and alternative process, again, these weren't areas where specific data pointed us to particular recommendations. In terms of the alternative processes, I believe that somewhere along the way, the idea of mediation as a possibility had come up, and some parallels were drawn to the nominate system, for example. But of course, to the extent we get into discussions around alternative processes, it's important that we bear in mind that the ERS is already an alternative to the UDRP, and that in some of those CCTLDs, for example, nominat, which is often mentioned, where there's a mediation possibility or different types of a summary or a full judgment or appeals, that those are actually subsidized by the registry. So that's something, of course, that we can recommend things, but we have to just appreciate that these recommendations don't occur in a vacuum. Just so we understand the big picture. So that's a quick rundown of what we covered in the document subteam, and I'd be happy to see if there's any questions. Otherwise, we can turn it over to Phil. So I see George, please go ahead.
Yeah, George Kirkos for the transcript. Yeah, I do want to note that these recommendations are just of the subteam members and shouldn't be given any extra weight to the group, particularly because the data that's forming the basis of this these suggested policy choices is not representative of respondents. It's still weighted heavily towards the providers
and the complainants of URS cases. And so there's various topics that I won't go to now that I disagree with the suggested course forward. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, George. I think I apologize if that wasn't clear. Certainly, all of the things that we've covered in this subteam were meant to be referred up to the full working group. I would just add, you know, to the comment that we did actually look at some of the determinations, so that could be another just to, you know, bear in mind that, you know, we looked at the providers and practitioner surveys, and then we did do a pretty good dive into some of the cases themselves. I don't see any other questions. I think maybe, sorry, I see George again.
George again. Yeah, I did want to point out, for example, the issue of latches, a statute of limitations. That's something where it wouldn't be reflected at all in the data, but it's certainly a topic that we need to discuss because these policies are probably not going to be renewed for another 5 or 10 years, so it's essential that we get it right going forward. You can't imagine that, you know, that a domain owner wants to be subject to these procedures after they've owned a domain name for 5 or 10 years. And even worse, if this policy becomes a consensus policy that applies to .com owners who've owned their domains for 20 or 30 years, it's ridiculous to have a 14-day response period for a rapid procedure once they've owned it for 20 years, where a case conceivably could not even be brought in the courts because of delay. Thanks.
Thanks, George. And that's certainly, you know, in terms of a statute of limitations, of course, it's up to the working group to agree on whether that's something that they want to make a policy recommendation on. And then the duration of the time to submit a response is, of course, a different question. Maybe we can move over to Phil, and if other questions come up, we can tackle those, you know, together. And I'm hoping that I know we only have 15 minutes left, but I think maybe some of this that Phil will present, we did see in Panama, so I'm hoping that we've left enough time to at least get through a good deal of this. So with that, Phil, I'm happy to turn over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Brian, and thank you for that great presentation, for taking over responsibility for that group even before you were confirmed as co-chair, and thanks also to Jason and Kathy for all their work on the practitioners sub-team. I'm now going to, given the limited time, there's going to be very view from 20,000 feet on the URS provider survey. Of course, all these surveys, the weight to be given to the data collected and recommendations, that's up to the full working group, and we're in no way bound by sub-team suggestions. The full working group can act or not act or act differently as it wishes. So let me get into this. We surveyed all three of the providers. I think everyone's aware that 90% plus of the URS cases have been brought with the National Arbitration Forum. So the data from the other two providers, while useful, is kind of supplementary to the data from the providers. And we thank the providers for all their work in responding to our questions and follow-up questions and requests for clarifications. It took them quite a bit of effort to get back to us on all the points we raised, and we still may be raising a few additional clarifying points. So with that background, let me jump in. I think given the amount of time, I'm just going to cover the green sub-team suggestions in this document. I don't think we have time today to discuss the staff suggestions, but everybody now has the full document, can review it, and we can get into greater depth in a future call. So this is under the complaint topic, the GDPR issue, sub-team recommendation to ask the Asian Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center, I'll be calling them ADN from now on for brevity, to explain why they accept complaints that do not contain all the elements required in the URS Rule 3B. And I will say generally we found some practices with ADN that raised some eyebrows where they were deviating from the black letter policy of the URS, and certainly the sub-team has targeted some of those findings with suggestions, and I would think that for the full working group, I don't want to predict, but asking URS providers to follow the basic rules and not deviate would not seem too controversial. Let's go on to the next page. No sub-team suggestions here. Let's keep going until we get to sub-team suggestions. On the SMD file, the recommendation is for the sub-team to ask all providers to confirm that their examiners are able to obtain the jurisdiction information of the trademark category of goods and services. This is important to know where the trademark is registered for these cases. Next page, and we have many pages here. I forget, this is a long document. I remember, I believe, 30-plus pages. Under administrative check, this is whether the provider's check to determine whether a domain cited in the URS complaint is already subject to an open UDRP or court case. And again, with ADN, we're going to ask them how they conduct cross-checks to determine whether a domain name is already subject to open an active URS or UDRP proceeding. I've misspoke about court cases, although I think that's covered. That is covered as well in the policy. And to ask the forum what triggers their suspicion that a domain name is subject to a pending URS or UDRP case. And we recognize that with a number of different UDRP providers and with all the jurisdictions in the world for court cases, it's impossible to be 100% sure, and it's certainly the respondent is the one with the best knowledge of whether there's already an action pending against the domain and is in the best position to raise it. But we do expect the providers to do adequate due diligence on this subject. So let's go to the next page. Notice of complaint. This is delivery. Now, the policy requires that upon receiving the complaint that the respondent be notified by an email to the address in the WHOIS database, by a fax to the phone number there, and by a postal mail to the address that's listed. And this sets aside the GDPR issue of access to this data, although the ICANN temporary specification continues to make that data available, so far as we're aware, available to URS and UDRP providers. We found that the forum and MFSD were following the policy, but that ADN was only sending an email. Could we go back there? I don't know why the page just jumped. That certainly, for me personally, raised a concern. We need to make sure that if the respondent chooses not to respond in any way, that's their choice. But the lack of response shouldn't be because they have not received adequate notice. So we are recommending that the look at changes in the operational rules, particularly ADNs, to assure compliance with that notice to the respondent. Next page. Keep going. Let's keep going. Okay, response. And this is about compliance checks for factors beyond the two items stated in URS Rule 5G, and who determines whether a response is non-compliant. Generally, we found that's the examiners. That's in their court to look at the response. It's not the provider's job. But the recommendation is the sub-team to review the following documents to consider whether further deliberation is needed, and that's the forum's Appendix B and the MFSD's checklist for administrative review of the response. So no clear-cut deviance there, but a little more due diligence required on that issue. Let's keep going. Okay, reasoning and determination. This was, you know, and Brian alluded to this. I think all of us who have looked at URS decisions have seen some which simply state that the elements have been satisfied and order suspension, and there's absolutely no explanation of what evidence that decision was based on. So the recommendation is the working group is to further examine divergent practices and requirements of the providers with regard to examiner providing reasoning in support of their determinations. It doesn't seem like asking for that would add much time or labor burden to the job of the examiner to deliberate on the forum's practice, which significantly deviates from that of ADN and MFSD. And when we scroll down next page, we can look at that. And just jump back so I can read the last point here. Working group discussed whether providers should give further guidance to examiners as to what, let's skip down now, basic elements should be included in every URS decision. And I would say there was a feeling within the provider sub-team that providing that guidance of what elements, basic elements should be in every URS decision would probably be a good step. We see here the responses that the various providers have given on that. So let's skip on the next one. But that is a significant issue. It's difficult in an appeal or in any future review of the URS to determine whether decisions were correctly made if they simply state we find the elements satisfied without citing the evidence on which that determination was made. Technical requirements. Now, this involves the fact that prevailing complainant can extend the domain registration for an additional year under current policy. That may or may not be adjusted when we get to looking at proposed changes, but that is the policy right now. But the thing is that even though it's the complainant extending the registration, the losing original registrant is the one who continues to be in the WHOIS record as the registrant, even though they're now out of the picture. So the recommendation is to re-examine the URS technical requirements and discuss whether technical requirement 3 and registry requirement 10 should be amended so that the extension of the domain registration at the request of the complainant reflects the complainant as the registrant during that 1 year extension rather than the losing original registrant. So let's go. Okay, late response fee. Working group to discuss whether any of the late response fees, can we jump down, create a burden for the respondent. That's something we can certainly discuss when we get to the decisional phase. Let's keep going. We're at page 26 now. I think there's about a 36-page document, and we're at 227. Okay, abusive process. Recommendation, working group to consider potential recommendation on the incorporation of penalties for the abuse of the process by the respondent in the URS rules, but that would require abuse, clarification of what exactly is being abused. So that's something we can certainly get into and discuss in the decisional phase of our work. And I do want to remind folks that we've already discussed the fact that if we get to proposals for changes in the URS for which there's a substantial view within the working group that they're intertwined with UDRP policy issues, or there's simply no consensus at this point in time, they can be deferred to phase two of our work. Just want to remind everyone of that. So complainant and respondent education, this is on page 27. We're going to review the notice of complaint and provider's online forms instructions before considering whether any additional education material should be developed. So that's a possible recommendation for additional education. Let's scroll down. Examiner education and training. We weren't completely satisfied with the response from ADN on the their panel selection process, and we're going to be asking them to elaborate and provide more information on that. URS providers, it just says working group to deliberate on these issues. And let's go to the next page, see what else we have. And that involved the fact that the there's some gaps here, particularly with ADN, on verifying their credentials and publicly displaying the credentials of their examiners, as is required by the policy. So, okay, down on page 32, we're going to ask ADN to confirm whether their examiners have voluntarily disclosed any conflicts, and working group is to deliberate on whether any explicit standard for removal of examiners with particular background is needed. For example, if someone has repeatedly represented serial cyber squatters. So all this is for full further discussion and deliberation at the full working group level. Row 92 is about inferences from URS Rule 12F, and a sub-team working group to examine the following cases to determine whether further deliberation is needed, and those are two MFSD cases. Let's continue. We're about toward the end of the document and toward the end of our time. Anything further is at the end of it. So obviously that was a very quick survey from 20,000 feet. We didn't look at the staff recommendations, but all of you have the document now, and we'll be engaging in further discussion on all these sub-team findings as we prepare to entertain proposals from working group members for either changes in URS policy or better guidance or enforcement regarding the administration of the policy. So I will stop there. We're 31 minutes past the hour, 1 minute over. Does anyone have a quick question? Otherwise, we'll get to noting the next meeting and next steps and any other business. And thank you, Kathy. Yes, I think we all found as we got into these sub-teams that the effort was very substantial, both in the number of questions, putting together the questions, putting them out, and doing initial reviews of the answers. So, and I'd be glad to take questions at the start of the next meeting, given the time situation, or on the working group email list between now and the next meeting. So I'm going to turn it back to staff to note our next meeting time.
This is Julie Hedlund from staff. So the next meeting is next week, Wednesday. That's the 8th of August, and it will be also at 1700 UTC for 90 minutes, and that is also noted in the chat.
Okay, and Brian, I see your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. I just wanted to, just for everyone's benefit, to say that, of course, we have a meeting scheduled for next week. I believe we have a co-chair call scheduled for tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe we can get back to the full working group over email with our kind of anticipated next steps and agenda for the meeting next week.
Yeah, and I see Kathy has typed in good idea, and I agree, Brian. So, and I think with that, we can probably wrap it up, and further discussion on any of these presentations can take place on the work group email list until the next meeting. So thank you all who attended today, and thanks very much to all the folks who participated in the three sub-teams, a tremendous amount of work done collectively at that sub-team level to inform the full working group. Goodbye.
Thanks, everyone, for joining. Today's meeting has been adjourned. Operator, can you please stop the recording? And everyone have a good rest of your day.